Our guest today is one of India's most distinguished ambassadors who served in the European Union, in Belgium, Luxembourg, and most important, in Nepal. He's here today to tell us about his vast experiences on those areas, as indeed on what is happening in international relations today. Let us welcome Manjeev Singh Puri. Welcome to the show, Mr. Manjeev Singh Puri. Having worked with you over many, many years, but good to have you back to our program. Welcome. Now, when you went to Nepal as the ambassador, this was 2015, soon after things had gone wrong because of the blockade. And obviously, you had to do a lot of repair work and moved on. And then things got sorted out. But then Nepal erupted, etc. When you were not there, Nepal erupted. But when you look at Nepal and in a perspective to see from 2015 and the time that you spent as ambassador, and then subsequently what has happened to Nepal, is there something that you think that we should have done or we could have done, which was more than what perhaps we have been able to do?
So let me sketch this like this. Why was I chosen to go to Nepal? One, I was then the senior most foreign service officer. You had to be sent to a country which was kind of important.
Yeah.
In the past, Indian ambassadors to Nepal have been of the senior most level. They've been cabinet ministers also and so on. The second, it was important to send someone who didn't carry previous baggage. In fact, when I joined Nepal, very soon a leading daily in India carried a report saying, oh, they've sent an ambassador there who's never dealt with Nepal, who brings Western ideas to this entire thing. But what should I say, sir? The fact that all this had happened, what you mentioned, resulted in Mr. K.P. Sharma Oli winning the election. But what was important, as India, the country with whom Nepal has the largest amount of linkages and with which we have inordinate civilizational links, we had to work with them. What did we do? I'm very proud, sir. A thing that was stuck for 20 years, this hydropower business, this major project called Arun 3, it started work on that. It's today two-thirds complete. Mr. Oli and Prime Minister Modi inaugurated it. Then we talk about this entire business of oil trade. The pipeline, the first pipeline in South Asia between Nepal and India was inaugurated there. And then let me say something on the politics. 2014, Prime Minister Modi, when he became Prime Minister, he had a huge welcome in Nepal when he went there. And then something did go wrong. In 2018, he was welcomed back in Nepal in the same Janakpur that people talked about, where 2014 there were issues there. He was welcomed there. He addressed a rally of more than 200,000 people, perhaps the largest rally overseas done by the Prime Minister, and welcomed by Prime Minister Modi in Janakpur. Sir, can I look back and say that in the 3 years I was there, 2017, 18 and 19, we actually took many things forward. Mm-hmm. And this was because the Nepalese also saw in themselves benefits. We were there to do it. Now the question that you ask, that, you know, these changes happen. Sir, Nepal is a country which we think there are civilizational ties, and they not only don't deny it, they know it. They wear the same kind of clothes as us. They eat the same foods. But as nation states, they've always had this business that we are Nepal and you are India. After all, not many people are aware that even during the British Raj, they ensured that they were not clubbed with Indian princely states. They were always retained as a foreign entity. And so this issue of, you know, the nation states and how it goes about the identity politics in Nepal is particularly important. And now one more very important thing. In the last 20, 30 years, Nepal has been exposed to globalization. We, through colonization, had always had an exposure to globalization. They had not as a monarchy. Their exposure to globalization, sir, is immeasurable. Nearly 25 to 30% of the population is overseas. And I'm not talking about India. They're in the Gulf. They're in Southeast Asia. They're in America. They're in Europe. Everybody's got a smartphone. The connect with globalization is tremendous. They may not have big cars, wide roads, tall buildings. But this concept of globalization has become integral to Nepal. And we need to understand that's where the aspirational aspects and so many things happen. But Nepal remains and will remain a country of critical importance to us as a nation state. And let me put it the other way around. We are indispensable for them.
Terrific. But tell me, your quick assessment of the new Prime Minister, Balin Shah. He's a remarkable history about him. He comes out as somebody who's emerged out of a movement, the Gen Z movement, etc. But where do you place him in the context of your understanding of Nepal?
Sir, I retired at the end of 2019. Mr. Balin Shah was nowhere on the scene. He was perhaps doing rock music, or he was a rapper, or whatever he was. But what are the changes? As I mentioned to you, sir, this exposure to globalization has brought about a kind of empowerment in the Nepalese society. And therefore, the understanding of what's happening in the world is something which is very strong with them. Now, the Gen Z movement has various factors. The immediate cause, as people say, was a ban on social media. But a ban that came about because the two largest parties in parliament, the Communist Party and the Nepali Congress, were together in a coalition. And so you have a sense of hubris and, you know, don't listen to the people. So these are small countries, although at 30 million, Nepal is not a small country by global standard. But in these countries, sir, people's aspirations and the politicians need to keep their ear to the ground and understand is important. It's quite possible that the government there said, well, we won the election, we are permanent, we have two-thirds majority, we will prevail. It didn't happen. The people protested, there were street protests, there were firings, killings, and you know what happened, everybody knows.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, Mr. Balin Shah, sir, had been elected 2 years earlier as the mayor of Kathmandu.
Right.
As an individual, defeating all the political parties. Why again? Because in the people, there is this aspiration. If I may give an example, this is my understanding, something like the Aap Aadmi, the Arvind Kejriwal movement. He won twice in Delhi, sir. Once getting 62 seats and one getting 67 out of 70. There's a kind of feeling among people that, can we have some change? So he's there. So he defeated K.P. Sharma Oli, the sitting prime minister, who had never been defeated from that constituency. But Mr. Balin Shah also has to, you know, in a sense, domestically say that I'm different. I'm not like the previous politicians. I am for Nepal, I'll do so. But it's important that there's a realization there too, that just as Nepal is important to India, we are in a sense, in any scale of indispensability, perhaps the country most important as far as Nepal is concerned. How do I see this going? We need to have engagement. I have little doubt in my mind, sir, that while my ilk and all of us are important, it's people like you, the political leaderships, when you interact with people. The Nepalese politicians know us very well, sir. We may perhaps not be knowing
them
that
traditionally, they've been very good friends. But are they discredited to the extent that they won't matter at all?
Sir, but the newer people are also politicians, isn't it, sir?
Right, right.
Are you saying that the RSP are not politicians? They're a new generation of politicians.
Right, right.
So there's a generational change that has taken place. There's no doubt about that. All the others were 70 years, 75 years plus. You have younger people, 35-year-old prime minister. Well, it may be somewhat difficult, but I am sure those who have politics in their blood know how to interact. Now, my understanding is you keep these relations up and ways and means can be found for people to understand that even for them, it's good governance is not enough, sir, as a leader of a country. There are external situations, ecosystems, etc., which are important. For me, the most important thing is India remaining engaged with Nepal.
All right, good. Now, come to the critical thing that always concerns us. And that's the, call it the elephant in the room or the dragon in the room, etc., China.
Yeah.
Where does China now fit in? China's interest in Nepal, China's desire to compete with India for attention of Nepal, etc. And what kind of onus does that place upon us so that we don't get obstructed by whatever the Chinese policy is?
Sir, there should be absolutely no doubt that the growth of China including in terms of its technological and financial prowess, has an issue. If we have 1,500 kilometers of a land border with Nepal, they have 1,400 kilometers on the other side. And the Nepalese have always been very mindful that they need to maintain a certain balance in relationship, not between India and China, but balance in their relationship with Nepal. Because, you know, this is the nature of the way that society has inculcated. That's the way they've protected themselves, called themselves, whatever they say, Switzerland of the East or neutral or whatever it is. It's their way of thinking. We have to be mindful. There's no question of not being mindful about that. But what does it mean? The Chinese have some advantages. As I said, they have technological money power. The disadvantages they have is of geography. We have all the advantages of geography. We have advantages of civilizational links. I believe you just have to keep up, stepped up interactions. Be mindful, note what the Chinese are doing, but let what they are doing not be an impediment to what you should do. Because in the longer run, we are also a country which is going to be among the biggest players in the world, sir.
Let's take you back to another area of your expertise and your engagement and involvement, and that's Europe. When we look at Europe and whatever is happening in the world today, with the United States-Europe relationship becoming a little ambiguous, very different from what it was 4 years ago, etc. And you've seen all this very closely. Now, in this scenario, where does India figure as far as Europe is concerned? Has Europe, from your perspective, from the time that you served there, has Europe seen us as an equal partner? Or has Europe just seen us as a possible market and the interest being limited only to a possible market? So where does Europe see us today? And how do we see Europe today?
On a lighter note, I must tell you, sir, I am the second chap from the Indian Foreign Service who has served as ambassador in the same station as his father had served. My father was India's ambassador to the European Union, where I got the telegram from the UPSC that you had been selected for the Indian Foreign Service.
Terrific.
And some 35 years later, I went and stayed in the same house. Sat in the same office room, and I have lovely photographs of my father being photographed there and me being photographed there. Some of the embassy staff were the same people. One or two of them addressed me by that familiar Baba and so on and so forth. And I used to tell people, I'm the only chap in Brussels who, other than the big man in that country, who has only progressed from the children's bedroom to the master bedroom.
Wonderful. So, sir, that's a great story.
Coming to that's the serious story, element. Yes. So they are our largest economic partner. Anything that we do here, our sense of comfort is maximum with European countries. You want to have norms for emissions, norms for gasoline, you take European norms. They're our largest investors here, second, third largest trading partners, huge amounts of equities which rest with both of them. And both need to understand that we are possibilities of partnerships for multipolarity in the world for both of us. The Europeans for a long time were focused on China as the only great market. In a sense, COVID has brought to their populations a realization, perhaps not for the right reason, but whatever it is, perceptual reason. The Russian issue with Ukraine has brought about other things. And finally, Mr. Trump. Transatlantic alliance seeing a rocking, something which nobody ever thought, and everyone said, after all, they are distant cousins and they have to be on the same page. And therefore, it gives opportunities. My understanding, both of us should see each other not just as partners, but as important and strategic partners.
And what we see things going forward is Russia's concerns about Ukraine and why the Ukraine war started, NATO's possible expansion, etc. Is that going to get addressed? Has India played a role there at all? Has India tried to do something as a peacemaker? I mean, we had good relations on both sides, including other European countries. So where do we stand?
So we had good relations with everyone. It's been part of what you may, in your times, you may have called non-alignment. Now we call it multi-alignment.
Yeah.
They're in a sense, different facets of the same sort of pyramid or whatever you may say. So this is a fight among the Western world. Do you really have much roles? The main role that you have is exactly what we've been saying, dialogue. But things really haven't been moving forward. Yet, and so therefore, what I mean is, this is something that we should urge them to try and find ways forward.
Could we have done more of that?
Sir, I'm not sure we could have done more, because look at the people who are involved. You have this Russia, a member of the P5. You have the Europeans with two P5 members, the British and the French. You have the Americans also involved for a very long time, forgetting President Trump's another member. So is there really any other role? Yes, you can make all the noises which we did. And remember, sir, we did manage to do this quite well. We had a declaration during the G20. The previous G20 in Bali, there could not have been a declaration. So we were able to manage things for our own self. But to be able to talk to the true biggies of the world, yes, you can tell them. But sir, beyond a point, they really have to be willing to do something. And this was, if you don't mind my saying so, in a sense, part of the Caucasian world, and they're having it out themselves. Are they willing to listen to others? I'm not so sure.
Well, in terms of consistency, has Europe been able to wean itself away from dependence on Russian gas? They tell us not to be purchasing Russian oil, but they continue to buy Russian gas, etc. So where does that stand? Is that a bit hypocritical or inconsistent?
Sir, it is hypocritical when you look at the figures in absolute terms. But sir, they've moved away. They've taken a great deal of hits, more than anyone else. After all, if the Ukrainians are fighting this war, the Europeans are paying for it in the real sense of the term. The Americans being far away, they have neither an oil or a gas shortage or in terms of money and their economy, various things. So the Europeans, sir, are old hands at playing both sides of the coin. Duplicity is not a word that we invented. But, sir, that's part of statecraft in the world. And so if they are having these particular impacts, it's hitting them. Today, what is the talk of the town? That the Europeans find some sort of way in the wake of President Trump reaching out to the Russians, wanting to do some kind of a deal, away from the neocon theories that you must have a diminished Russia, back to the detente views that there is Russia and you and we can exist together. So these are world views which come about, and obviously the United States and the UK are big purveyors of all of these. And in all of this, the EU is now grappling with the idea that should you have some kind of a back channel with the Russians, and they're not able to get over it, because in 27 countries it's very easy for somebody to say no and block anything happening. It's not particularly easy to take things forward, and if they don't do things together, then it's not a meaningful thing.
So if I was to ask you, and we could seriously look at, we have to plan 3-4 steps that India must take looking at this entire picture, and India to improve its own profile vis-a-vis all these countries and all these theaters of foreign policy engagement, what are the critical important steps you would advise India to take today?
Sir, for me, the most important element, and I think if anybody else had any doubts about it in the context of President Trump, it would be very clear, which is the economy. The fact that we are $4 trillion is not sufficient. We need to hugely invest in our economy and take our economy forward. What do we do with it? I believe we need to really look at multi-alignment in the real sense of the term. We build relations with the Japanese. Let's actually make them happen on the ground. The Europeans, we are, sir, a hesitant bureaucracy. And I understand why my colleagues are hesitant, because they say if things go wrong, we will be blamed. But, sir, you have to take those risks. You remember, sir, in the 1990s, we opened up our economies. And various things happened. That's how we became known as the economy which was making all the differences. That's how the BRIC acronym came about. That's how we changed, from my understanding when I joined the service, of a developing country which went to aid meetings to a big economy which mattered and which wrote the largest check that was possible. So these particular things are important. So in my view, growing the economy is without doubt the most important element. It will help you with everything, including your ability to defend yourself strongly, to be able to do other things for national security.
Terrific. But tell me, when we had our differences, Operation Sindoor with Pakistan, etc., was there a sense of disappointment in terms of the response that we should have got from European countries, and particularly because we have such an important relationship with them?
I don't know, sir, what was your understanding when you went on the Sindoor thing? My understanding was very clear. the countries chosen to which we were sent were countries which were either serving on the Security Council or going to serve on the Council during 2025 and 2026.
That's right.
Sir, Pakistan has not been able to do anything against India in the UN Security Council despite having a membership of the Security Council. In a sense, the European countries did deliver. Now, to have expected that they would have done anything against somebody who's a sitting member of the Security, that's a bit too much. But Pakistanis didn't manage to get any leeway on that. Of course, many other things have happened. The world has moved on, but that's...
What happened with the delegation that they sent? I mean, what was
the feedback? So they went to two, three places, from what I understand. They went to the Russians, they went to Turkey, and they went to the United States and a few others, friends of theirs. So they must also do that. Everybody is in the same business. The way I look at it is, in the focused element of what we were attempting with the outreach, we've had success. But I'm very happy on something else, sir, which should make gladden your heart.
What is that?
That we were able to tell the government and put across to them that MPs matter. And MPs from the opposition matter a lot. So what did I see in the delegation that I was a member of? I was the sort of expert on that delegation. When somebody got up and said, I am an MP, I represent 10 million people, and I am from the opposition. Everybody got up and said, wow, this is an all-India effort. India is involved. India is thinking like this. So it makes a difference. Was that not your feeling?
Well, that is absolutely correct. But I thought that this had happened after a long time.
Yes, sir.
You know, I sort of recall the time that Mr. Atal Bihari Vajpayee and I went together, and he was the leader of the delegation to the Human Rights Commission. And I remember that as being a moment of consensus where one voice spoke for India, whoever it was, opposition or us. And I thought that very late this thing happened again, but it should be happening more often, that parties meet more often, we try to develop consensus more often, but I don't know, for some reason, for several years, that hasn't happened.
Sir, not being a member of parliament, I can't comment on it, but in my understanding, while political parties in any countries in the world, they have a large number of issues among themselves, after all, they fight elections.
Sure.
At the end of the day, there's a bipartisanship which takes place. And no other example is as good as the one that you were there, Atal Bihari Vajpayee ji, you and Mr. Farooq Abdullah.
Yes.
In fact, you would agree, sir, if it had not been this particular combination, the Pakistanis may just have edged ourselves.
Might just have, yeah.
This combination told everybody in the Western world who were otherwise clamoring for, you know, human rights in Kashmir to say, hey, the only guys who we are turning to are all here and saying this is not what is happening. The game was over for them. So this is India. This is my understanding.
That's terrific. Wonderful. That's really wonderful. Now let's talk a little bit about strategic matters. Let's talk about defense alliances, etc. Where do we stand with Russia? Russia has been a solid supporter as far as defense supplies are concerned. And, you know, we've developed BrahMos, which was so effective in the Operation Sindoor. And now it's in great demand across the globe. We've developed that together, BrahMos. But where do we stand vis-a-vis Russia and other suppliers that we seek support from? Where do we stand today? Is it a different picture than it was, say, 20 years ago? Or is it something that's sustainable and still the same?
So the picture is always evolving. After all, 20 years back, was India one of the countries that counted, that we were fourth or fifth or whatever, sixth largest economy in the world? Was that the case, that we had a GDP larger than Russia? No. That they are tremendous suppliers, both, sir, of defense equipment and nuclear and so on and so forth. And these have stood the test of time as far as we are concerned. Sir, Sindoor, it was not just the BrahMos, the famous rockets. The S-400s, look at their performances. So we all know this. But the Russians have also been, sir, strong, even without making much of a noise on it, in supporting us on lots of things. Remember, sir, after the Pahalgam attacks, there was a UN Security Council resolution that condemned it. Do you think it would have been possible? It's just a conjecture. I have no evidence. You think it would have been possible? The Chinese would have very clearly said, don't do it. How do you think it would have happened? Without at least the Russians pushing, nudging something or the other to say, look, this is something which is wrong, which has happened. And this is something on which the world must come together. And hence that resolution in the UN, which said pretty much what we wanted it to say. May not be a full length of
sure,
all of
sure,
that.
Yeah.
But it did say many of these things, including pointing to those who were responsible and so on through it. So therefore, sir, there is a relationship, and a relationship which is important. President Putin comes to India for a state visit. We have these regular exchanges. Russia, in my understanding, continues to remain for India a partner of trust, a partner of great deal of abilities. Oil, we haven't mentioned that. So we know what is happening in the world. You know, sometimes you have to play this geopolitics game. You buy from here, you don't buy from here. But at the most critical of times, have they not been of great importance to us? Today, we are talking in terms of building a Vladivostok-Chennai corridor. We're talking in terms of shipbuilding and so on. So Russia, sir, for all its problems, remains a huge hub of engineering capabilities, huge hub of resources, not just oil. We don't know what will happen about strategic minerals in times to come. The largest country in the world, sir, Moscow to Vladivostok is 9,890 kilometers. So there's a pillar at the Vladivostok railway station. When you see it, you say, yes, sir, you are big. That's the nature of the game.
Yeah.
And so therefore, it's a relationship of importance. The largest society in the world, India, the largest economy, the United States, the largest country in terms of land. These are relationships which are important.
Okay, now we've done the whole world virtually, but you've just barely touched upon Iran and the issues that Iran faced. We've been impacted, we've been affected by the war in Iran. But if you look at the continuum of first the attacks on Gaza and what happened in Gaza, and we really were in a very difficult position because it wasn't clear as to what position we would take. Israel has good relations with India. We are dependent on Israel in many ways, etc. But we couldn't have endorsed what Israel did or to the extent to which Israel went. Now, once that is over, and now that the agreement has been signed, although it seems a little bit shaky, where are we and how do we look forward and beyond whatever has happened?
We are a growing economy. Sir, we need fuel. There should be no two ways about it. We need to import fossil fuels. We don't have it at the moment. We discover more. Perfectly good. We move towards green hydrogen. We do resilience. We do renewable energies. Excellent. But in the very near term, means another 10 odd years, you will be reliant on imports of these things. And so diversification is extremely important. This includes the Russian oils. We should be very clear. We need it. You can give it, fine. We can buy from the United States, buy from Venezuela, but we will also buy Russian. We need to be firm on this and build other alternatives to the reach out to the Gulf countries. These are important elements. Why are they important? Why do I say, sir? So as we chase Viksit Bharat 2047, you can't underplay the importance of fuels. And all of this cannot be done domestically. We are a fuel-reliant economy and we would need it. And we need it. Therefore, we need to work on this. I believe on both climate change, sustainability, as well as all of this, is a national security imperative, not just as a development imperative.
So that's the task cut out for us. And that's a lot of things to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Manjeet Singh Puri.
Sir, thank
Wonderful
you very
to
much.
Have you back
An honor,
with
sir.
Us. Thank you.
Thank you.